Devoncast
from Radio X.
Welcome to Devoncast, your regular dose of Devon in podcast form. Thank you for listening. Wherever you're listening to us, you might be listening in the car, you might be listening walking the dog. Do you know we had somebody say they were listening in the bath? How does that make us feel?
Well, that's amazing.
That is amazing. That is pretty amazing. We'll be talking politics. We'll be talking big issues. We'll be talking small issues. All the things that affect you that are governed by your local councils, your local politics, and we'll be talking much more. Devoncast comes from Radio X and the Local Democracy Reporting Service. It's available on the Radio X website, from your usual podcast provider, and from the all-new Devoncast Radio, which is available on DAB Digital Radio. Just ask the little pod in the corner of your room to play Devoncast Radio. I'm Guy Henderson.
I'm Josh Tate.
And I'm Paul Nero.
We'll get round to introducing you in a few moments. But Josh, introduce yourself. You're certainly bringing the average age of Devoncast presenters down quite considerably.
Well, yeah, I've just turned 18 years old and you may have heard me on the radio. I do news reading. I had the odd show at the start of this year, but I was dubbed Britain's youngest newsreader at 16 years old on this radio station.
So, yeah, so welcome along. This is the first time we've actually had you on Devoncast, but it won't be the last. So welcome along for this one. And here, not for the first time, is the gaffer. The boss is with us today. Paul, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be a guest for a change. I don't think I've ever sat in this chair before. I'm normally sitting where you're sitting, Kelly.
There you go. So this is I'm going drunk with power here because I'm sitting here driving a podcast with the boss sitting in one of the guest chairs. So there you go. We've got a packed Devoncast for you this week as ever, as we build up to what could be a very busy year of elections.
We'll be talking about the possibility that we may soon have a radical new way of voting and discussing a bit of a kerfuffle over politicians' websites. Plus, we've been to one of Devon's most historic buildings to hear a huge restoration project and a tiny green bottle. And we've been delving into the story of how rock and roll came to South Devon, thanks to one larger-than-life character.
Thanks, Josh. Let's start with politics and that story about those websites. Josh, what's it all about?
Well, there's been some local political news over the last week about two local MPs and suspicion over people being redirected to the other MP's website. So Conservative MP for East Devon, Simon Jupp, and Richard Ford, who's Liberal Democrat for Tiverton and Honiton, will go head-to-head for the next general election at their new constituency area. It emerged anyone typing richardford.uk, richardford.co.uk, or even richardford.com would be redirected to Mr. Jupp's website. I caught up with Richard Ford earlier this week and this is what he had to say.
Voters need to have confidence in the people that they are voting for and the people they elect, and they want to have certainty that they can trust the people who they're voting for, that those individuals have integrity. Now, I have no idea who has set up this sort of fake domain, or rather this sort of rerouted domain that mean that you can type in simonjupp.co.uk and you get to his website, but you can also type in richardford.co.uk and get to his website. I don't know who set that up, but I think that sort of underhand election tactics is just the sort of thing that really puts people off politics. And it's the kind of thing that is going to make people switch off and turn away and not vote.
So Simon Jupp made it clear that he has nothing to do with it. Do you have any ideas, or do you have any thoughts about what has happened?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how this is. I understand that in technical terms, it's quite straightforward to buy a domain and to have that domain redirect to a different website. It's not difficult to do. And I should add, it's not illegal either. But for me, this isn't about legality. This is about morality, and this is about ethics. And it's not. It's just not how people want to have the system operating. I mean, I'm making no particular accusation here, but it is. It just seems a little bit underhand that somebody somewhere in a campaign or some sort of somebody who's close to that campaign may have bought this domain and had this redirect set up, it's not the type of politics people want. They just want straightforward prospectuses. You know, I am standing on this platform, I pledge to do this, and and then for us to go away and fulfil those commitments that we make at election time.
What are the possibilities it could have been done by someone from your team?
Nil. I can say that with confidence. There is no possibility of that. I would add that, and I've talked to my team about it, and you know, my interest is partly around defence and security. I'm the Liberal Democrat defence spokesperson. And you know, we live in an age where cyber attacks happen, and you know there is in conflict between states. Sometimes we sort of see these kind of cyber attacks and these false flag attacks. But I can be absolutely certain that nobody on my team would do this. I trust every individual implicitly, and. It's rather the case, I think, that the motivation for doing this would have probably been somebody willing on the Conservatives to win at the general election. Honiton and Sidmouth is going to be a marginal seat, and I dare say that there is an effort to pull out all the stops. But we've just got to be careful. There is a line that we must not cross in political campaigning. And we've got to keep it straight. It's not just about electoral law. It's not just about what the Electoral Commission is policing. It's also about what is honest and straightforward. That's what voters want to see.
Simon Jupp told us he's not responsible for the web domains in Mr. Ford's name, which link to his own website. The Electoral Commission said it would not be looking into what happened as well.
It's a fascinating story, that, though, isn't it? Because you look back in years gone by when Paul and I would have been covering elections, there were always stories about people pulling up posters, pulling down posters. This is the modern equivalent, isn't it? There's always these things happen during elections.
The thing about pulling down posters is that they are very visible and they are very public. You've got to actually make a decision to go to an MP's website. Do you think many people actually do? Many members of the public actually go to an MP's website. You have to be interested in the politics right now. And I don't think many people are. So who is going to do this? Richard Ford there is very clear. The chances of anybody from his team doing it are nil. And he says he's making no particular accusation here, but somebody close to that campaign, the Conservative campaign, might have. Anybody can buy one of these domain names. Why would anybody do this? It can only be political shenanigans in some form, can't it? Both those MPs we know to be sort of quite bright people. They know that they're going to get caught if they do this. So I think it's highly unlikely it's the MP. I think it's highly unlikely that it's any of the MP's team, in my opinion. I'd be interested to know yours, Guy. Well, but an activist, maybe, on either side.
It sounds very much as if it's somebody who's doing it almost as a prank, wouldn't it be a laugh to do this? But the thing, as you say, people tend to use Google or other search engines. If I want to go and look at Richard Ford's website, I'll probably type Richard Ford into a search engine. I'm not sure that I would go to the trouble of typing in a whole URL. So,
but presumably, that search engine URL goes then to Mr. Jupp's website. Is that how it works? Josh, you will know.
Let's ask a young person, Paul.
So what I've seen from typing up Richard Ford's website on my phone, it doesn't matter what you type up. If you're typing up richardford.com.co.uk into the top of your search engine, it takes you straight and direct to Simon Jupp's website. Well, it did until it got taken down.
Okay. So it's quite an effective prank.
Why would you do this? And it's maybe a prank. It may be somebody thinking that they can help Simon Jupp's campaign. But from the start, it can only damage the campaign of the person who's going to get caught, can't it? And I think it probably has done quite a lot of damage. Of the people I've spoken to, some people are not entirely happy with the Conservatives pulling what looks like a dirty trick. But it's a dirty trick you'd have to be really stupid to do.
And we know from experience that's not going to be the last that we hear across Devon of a bit of shenanigans going on around the election campaign. That's part of what makes the rich tapestry of an election campaign, isn't it? You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X with Guy Henderson, Josh Tate and Paul Nero. We're available on the Radio X website, from your usual podcast provider, and from the all-new Devoncast Radio on DAB Digital Radio. Now, if you ever drive down to the seafront at Torquay, and why wouldn't you, because it's lovely, the chances are that you'll make your way through the craziest junction in the whole of Devon. You'll be distracted by the six-way free-for-all at the gates of a place called Tor Abbey. Traffic lights point in all directions, there are no pedestrian crossings, they'll be honking, they'll be shouting, and you won't notice the magnificent building behind the gates. Tor Abbey is something a bit special. She went down there yesterday. It was lovely down there yesterday because there's a big restoration project going on, and I've been finding out a little bit more about that. Torbay's most important historic building hides in plain sight just off the busy seafront. Thousands of people drive past Tor Abbey every day. Its gates front onto one of Torquay's busiest road junctions. But few people know the history of the remarkable building, which dates back to the 12th century in the reign of Richard the Lionheart. Originally a monastery, it's had numerous uses through the years. Mayors of Torbay have received VIP guests there, and just after the war the Olympic flame burned over Tor Abbey as the world's best sailors raced in the bay. It has the same official designation as Stonehenge, a scheduled monument, and Torbay Council owns it. Now a major restoration project is peeling back the layers of the Abbey's history piece by piece. A Meet the Builders Day gave people a chance to talk to the team behind the project and find out a bit more about some of the exciting things they've found. We spoke to the Abbey's manager, Lucinda Heron, about the project.
We're doing lots of repairs and conservation to the gatehouse, which is why the scaffolding looks so epic. Probably see it from space, I'm not sure. And then we're also doing some work on the chapel, which is sort of coming into its own now as the project moves along. And right at the end of the project, we're going to start doing a little bit of landscaping out at the front on the South Range to reinstate the carriage sweep, do some replanting, get rid of the tarmac and put down a surface that's much more in keeping with the place and reclaim the front steps. So it's all about that South Range and the gatehouse with the chapel as well. And those works are needed because currently a lot of those areas are closed to the public because they'd got to the point where they were too unsafe for us to have them open. And we've had to move all of our collection out of them because, again, not safe to have the collections in there. So again, at the end of this project, it'd be really lovely because we'll be able to reopen those spaces for our visitors to come and see in the future. The project started last summer. They came on site, moved in. The builders moved in last summer. And we're hoping, if everything goes to plan, that it'll be finished by the end of August this year, so 2024. And that's when it'll all be uncovered and unwrapped, which is a lovely time for us to do that because we're celebrating our 90th anniversary of being open to the public. So at our summer fair at the end of August, we're going to be celebrating the end of the project and our 90th anniversary.
Restoring the Abbey is a huge job and it doesn't come cheap. Who's footing the bill for the work to be done to restore the jewel in Torbay's historical crown?
It's a nearly £2 million project overall now. A big chunk of it has come from the DCMS, the Department of Cultural, Media and Sport, and that's been administered by the Arts Council, and it's a fund called MEND, which is specifically for buildings that are owned by local authorities or people who are in partnership with local authorities, and that those buildings are significant enough and they need fixing and they need urgent repairs. So we sort of fitted the bill for all of that. So we applied for some money there and we were lucky enough to get a fair chunk from them. And that is basically the gatehouse and the west wing and the chapel. That's the part of it they're funding. As part of that process, we had to have a report from Historic England advisor to support our application. When they came and visited us, a very interesting day for us, but they also then told us that this west wing as well was, although it didn't look like it, was it much as much risk as the east wing, and so they advised that urgent works were needed there as well. So we went away and scratched our heads a bit and thought, what do we do now, because that obviously changed the cost of the project quite a bit. So we looked at other funding streams, and that is being funded by the National Heritage Memorial Fund, which is part of the National Lottery. And then obviously Torbay Council are match funding because they're the owners of the building. And also we have a local group that supports us, the Friends of Tor Abbey, and they've put in a significant amount as well. So that patchwork brings us up to the £2 million overall.
And how are the people of Torbay reacting to the work being done on their abbey?
think we are sort of hiding in plain sight almost. I think it's that thing, isn't it, that people drive past or walk through with their dogs every day and probably don't know what's inside, you know. And I think one of the things this project, interestingly, one of the things this project has done, because we've stayed open, we've reached a different audience. People are really engaged with us, and that the Meet the Builders Day, this is the second one that we're doing, has helped that process, I think. So it's made people look at the Abbey in a different way, and we're really pleased about that. It was a fairly brave decision to stay open. The Abbey's always closed when it's had big building works previously, but we have stayed open and our visitor numbers are better than they've ever been. So it was worth doing. It's brought its own challenges, but it's put us on the map, I think. The scaffolding's definitely put us on the map, but, you know, it's given us the opportunity to talk about the Abbey in a different way. And I think the really important thing about the Abbey, the building tells 800 years of people living in a place and how buildings have been used and changed over that time. And some of the archaeological discoveries we've made during this project have really highlighted that as well and brought those spaces to light for us. And we're going to be in a position to tell some really exciting stories when we reopen the gatehouse, for example.
That was Lucinda Heron, the manager of Tor Abbey. Archaeologists working as part of the team have been getting under the skin of the old building and making some surprising finds. Here's Marcy Weeks of Oakford Archaeology.
During the restoration process, we're here to monitor primarily the historic building recording. So as things like layers of plaster come off of the walls, we look at the masonry underneath and see if we can build a picture of the different phases of building, what rooms might have been used for originally. Oftentimes we find things like blocked up windows, and we can create a real picture of how the Abbey changed over time.
Sure enough, the Abbey yielded an unusual piece of glassware that got the archaeologists thinking.
Very excitingly, we found an incredibly rare glass bottle during some analysis of a fireplace. When we unblocked this little small hole between the fireplace and the lava shelf, one of my colleagues actually uncovered a glass bottle. It had been tucked around a corner, and this glass bottle is incredibly exciting, as it is one of only sort of five or so complete or near complete types of these bottles. And this one is in exceptionally good condition, perhaps even the most sort of well preserved of this specific type that we have ever seen. They're called a Wyvern Oval Flask, which is a bit of a mouthful, but essentially they're small glass bottles with a swirled pattern on the outside. They're formed through the process of blowing glass into a mould with ridges, and as they blew into the mould, they would twist the bottle, and that would form a sort of swirled pattern on the outside. They then remove it from the mould and lightly squish it to form a flat oval shape. So these bottles are thought to have been used to hold things like holy water or precious oils or perhaps perfumes. So very high expense, precious liquids. The bottles themselves were incredibly difficult to make and in themselves very, very expensive. So it's very exciting that we have a complete one of these bottles at this site.
So this shows the prestige that surrounded the Abbey in the 16th century, which is the era from which the bottle is thought to date.
Oh, most certainly. So the sort of gatehouse of the Abbey would have held sort of guests of very, very, very high status. Abbeys often attracted individuals of these sort of upper wealths. So having an object like this really does show us the sort of people who may have been sort of staying here and interacting with the space. And especially if it did hold something of religious significance, like a precious oil or holy water, it does also help with that sort of side of the history and story as well.
It all demonstrates how much the project is shedding new light on Tor Abbey, the treasure hiding in plain sight on Torquay seafront.
I think it shows how little we know about a lot of the buildings that we have in our local environment. And with this brilliant opportunity of the restoration project, we can really see in detail that we have so much more to learn about our own histories in these areas.
That was Marcy Weeks of Oakford Archaeology. For the latest information on the restoration and details of any future open days or tours, take a look at the Abbey website or follow its feeds on social media.
You're listening to Devoncast from Radio X with me, Josh Tate, Guy Henderson and Paul Nero, available on the Radio X website from your usual podcast provider and from the all-new Devoncast Radio on DAB Digital Radio. Just ask your smart speaker in the corner of your room to play Devoncast Radio and we'll be right there.
Josh, you've been talking to MPs all across the county this week. Labour's Luke Pollard, MP for Plymouth, Sutton and Devonport, is the next man in your sights. Tell us more.
Yeah, so I've been talking to the Labour MP about how we can encourage younger people and more people into politics and voting. I'm 18 years old and I'm an advocate for getting more younger people involved. I believe that going to a polling station to vote on a piece of paper is becoming somewhat outdated, especially if the majority of my generation spend their time on their phones. I know a lot of people who spend maybe 7-8 hours a day on their phones online, and I have a feeling a bunch of, let's say, 18 to 24 year olds wouldn't go to the polling station. I'm not saying everyone won't turn up. I feel like more people would vote if they could on their phones or online. So I asked a Labour MP for Plymouth, Devonport and Sutton what he thought of potentially online voting.
Well, I'd like to see our democracy renewed, and to do that we not only need to see MPs perform better in the House of Commons. I'm not a fan of the Yabu sucks, the shouting, the childish behaviour that you see broadcast every week on Prime Minister's questions. We need to look at, in my mind, the whole system of politics. I'm not a fan of voting on a Thursday, which means people who are at work or education or college can't get to the polling station as easily. I think that should be a weekend. I'm not a fan of the way that there's been voter suppression policies introduced by the government that makes it harder for people to vote. So you have to bring photo ID, which for lots of young people they may have with the provisional driver's license, but lots of young people won't have access to that. So that makes it harder for young people to vote. So I think it's absolutely right to look at how do we encourage more people to be able to vote. So I'm a Democrat. Above all, I want people to participate in elections. I'd like them to vote Labour, but I want people to use their votes. And at the moment, we seem to have a government going the opposite direction, making it harder for people to use their votes. So let's make it easier. Let's make it easier to register to vote, easier to get a postal vote. I would love to see online voting trialled. Look, if we can vote in X Factor and Britain's Got Talent on our phones, why can't we make a decision about who should represent us to increase participation in elections? Now, some of these arguments I have to make within my party. We're not yet there, and we haven't yet published our manifesto to saying out what are those changes that we will make. But renewing our democracy, I'm absolutely certain, will be a part of Labour's manifesto. And it needs to happen, because otherwise trust is going to continue to erode from our political system. And the danger of that is that you see extreme voices, people on the far right of politics in particular, taking advantage of that, seeking to divide our country even more. And if that happens, then it's more likely that we'll see some of those really awful right-wing extremism that we see at the moment, sadly, in the Netherlands and maybe in America, coming to the fore in Britain. And we need to avoid that at all costs.
What would the time span be of perhaps trialling phone voting or online voting?
Well, we could introduce online voting today if we wanted to. The problem is the case has not been made for that. And in my mind, we have to be very cautious about just adopting a silver bullet approach, pretending that either online voting or proportional representation or any one policy measure is what's required to renew our democracy. In my mind, this is my personal view, we need a whole suite of measures. We need a package that says, look, our democracy is being eroded, not just because of the lack of trust in politicians, not just because of the antics of lockdown parties and lying to Parliament, but because of the deliberate misinformation being injected into our political system by those countries who are opposed to our values, Russia and China, for instance. So we need to look at this in the round. Now, many of those changes, which I think can and should and ought to be made, are relatively simple. Of course, we need to make sure they're secure. We need to make sure that there's no opportunity for outside interference. But I think they can be made. What we have to do is make a case for them. And in my mind, renewing our democracy is just as important as renewing our public services. But when everything is broken, and that's a sentiment that people often share with me when I'm knocking on doors, we've got to make sure we're prioritising those things that have the biggest impact straight away. That's getting growth into our economy, rescuing the NHS. And they're the things that I would expect a Labour government to prioritise in the first few months, having won a general election. But I do want us to get to renewing our democracy, because it doesn't feel at the moment that our democracy is in a healthy condition.
That was Luke Pollard talking to you about maybe some changes in the way that we go about our voting. Now, I think that a lot of this might be down to the age of people and how familiar they are and how comfortable they are with using smartphones. Josh, you're going to be a first-time voter this time around, aren't you?
I am, and it's exciting. But it's also a strange feeling, because I've grown up my entire life spending time on mobile phones, tablets, computers, and to go to a polling station, which could be a little village hall, to use a scrappy bit of pencil to cast my vote, it just feels very strange. I would definitely prefer, and I'm sure in the future, to have the chance to vote on my phone, online. But it's that change, and it's when that change will happen and could happen. I was speaking to Richard Ford yesterday about the same subject, and he said during lockdown, the pandemic, that politicians were voting on key issues online, and they need a system which is strong enough and protect, and it's like stable enough. But that surely that can happen in the next 15 to 20 years. I hope it happens, because I've got a feeling that my generation, the younger generation nowadays, aren't going to want to spend time to walk down to a village hall to cast their vote. And I feel like every vote is a vote to vote. Everyone's got to have their voices heard.
Now, Paul and I are bristling at this. I actually like the rigmarole of going to a polling station.
I like the rigmarole of going to a polling station as well. And it's not that it's particularly social. There are people outside who ask you how you're going to vote, and I growl at them and tell them to mind their own business. But there has to be ways of this working for everybody, don't they? But they've got to get it right. Guy, do you remember the US election in 2000? I was in America, yeah, at the time of that election. They'd used some kind of technology in Florida, and it failed, didn't it?
It did.
So we were without knowing who was going to be the next American president for something like 4 or 5 weeks, because the technology wasn't quite right. So you've got to get the technology right, and still technology isn't robust enough. We see that at the moment with a Horizon IT scandal with the post office. You might claim that's 20 years ago as well. But this very morning, I tried to register for a postal vote for the local elections, police and crime commissioner elections, in a few weeks' time, Thursday, the 2nd of May. And I have failed in that attempt. And there can only be two reasons for that. Either it's me as a Neanderthal, or whatever the word is. What's the word? And you're going to edit this out?
Neanderthal.
Thank you. Me as a... yeah. It's either me or it's the technology. And actually, on this occasion, I don't think it was me. So there was a question in there, which was, can you write your own signature? I took that to mean, can you write your own signature? What do you think it means, Guy?
Can you write your own signature? Are you capable of writing your own signature?
Yeah, that's what I think. So do you have any disabilities that will stop you in a postal vote writing your own signature? To which the answer is, yes, I can write my own signature. I go through to the next screen and it says, now please write your signature, take a photocopy of it on your phone and upload it to this portal. I don't have the technology with me right there to do that.
No.
Yeah? It didn't mean, can you physically do it? It meant, can you now... write your own signature. Take a photo of the signature, upload the signature, then we might consider putting you through to the next screen. And you can't go back to correct that question. So I failed. And I'll have to go through it again, and that was sort of 10 or 15 minutes into the process. So I'm labouring this point, but you've got to get that technology right. So I don't see any reason why, providing it's secure, anybody could use a mobile phone to vote. I think it takes the fun out of it.
I think it does. I like putting the dog on his lead and walking up to the polling station in the rain and casting my vote. I don't mind having one of those little pencils. It's fine by me.
I liked Luke Pollard's suggestion of it being held on a different day of the week. The French do these on Sundays, I think. I think Vladimir Putin had it Friday to Sunday. You had 3 days to vote for him.
Were there other candidates, Paul?
There were other candidates, but yeah, you got a special award, I think, if you voted for Putin twice. We need to be very careful. He listens.
He's an avid Devoncast listener, I've been told.
But there would be other ways as well. What do you think about being paid to vote, Guy?
I don't agree with that. I think we all have a responsibility to vote, and it shouldn't depend onto any kind of incentive. I mean, people have died to get us the right to vote.
Indeed.
We should use it.
When you go and give blood at the end, you get a cup of tea or coffee, you get some crisps, you get some nice biscuits and all that kind of thing. It's a nice little experience to say thank you. You could offer incentives for people to go and vote.
Well, I'm sure that if you had those incentives in place, more younger people will go to the polling stations. I'm in a stage where I get to vote for the first time, but some of my colleagues at, let's say, college, or people I go out and talk to, they have no need or no desire to go and vote at this next general election. And it hurts me a little bit because this is our future,
yeah.
And they're not paying any attention, and they don't want to go and vote for what could happen in the next few years. That there could be something where you go, you could get a drink, you could get biscuits and stuff just for going to vote, which it could work, but I feel like the first steps maybe to get this younger generation involved in voting would be changing to online and have it both. Have you can go online and go to a polling station, but there should be an online system, not everything based on paper. We're in the 21st century. It does feel like what's going on now is so outdated.
How about making it mandatory, Josh?
Well, I'm not sure if mandatory voting is the right answer, but that is a way forward, because in Australia, you could go to prison if you don't go to vote, which...
Can you imagine the expense of enforcing that, though, of actually making that stick?
Well, it's something that could happen, and if it happens, it will be a great initiative to get more people involved in voting. But the thing with that is, will people vote for what they want, or will they just vote for something, will they just go and vote something on paper? There could be an answer where on the polling piece of paper it says none of the above.
Dartmoor prison's already full, isn't it? Everybody would be six to a cell.
They would. Josh, do me a favour, when the Police and Crime Commissioner vote comes around on May the 2nd, go out to a polling station, just experience the joy of walking in the rain to a school hall or a village hall or whatever, and just enjoy the rigmarole of voting.
And it really is important for Devon and Cornwall Police and Crime Commissioner. I think this is the fourth time we've gone to the polls for this. I can't remember, you're near the computer guy. What is the turnout for a Police and Crime Commissioner election? 10-11%, I think, something like that.
It's lowish.
Yep. So in most of Devon, there are no other polls on that day. In Plymouth, a third of the seats are being fought. In Exeter, a third of the seats are being fought at council level. So they'll get two votes. At that time, those people can vote for their councillor, which is already a low turnout.
Yeah.
And will also have the ability to vote for Police and Crime Commissioner. So there's probably an incentive for those people to get the Police and Crime Commissioner form as well. But for everybody else, is that office and an elected office visible enough, important enough, for people to go down to the polls, as you say, with a stubby pencil when it's raining? I'm afraid you're the exception in sticking your dog on the lead on that day, Guy, and too few people are doing that.
Well, thinking about it, people my age, going to vote at an actual general election is low as it is.
Yeah.
Going to vote at a Police and Crime Commissioner election, I would be surprised if it's over 1%, 18 to 24-year-olds actually turn out for these, which it's bad. It is bad. I think maybe only the politics students will go to those elections because they've been told to go.
But a packet of custard creams, which you were suggesting, it's not going to change that, is it?
A packet of custard creams...
I'd go twice.
A packet of custard creams could change at a general election, but when you go for the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, I highly doubt that 18 to 24-year-olds will take the time out of their day, especially on a Thursday as well. It's a day where they'll be at work. They've got before work and after work. What time do the polls close?
7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. You've got all the time in the world.
But is it not 10 o'clock at night, Paul? It's late.
Let's do that bit again. Seven o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night.
But I doubt 18 to 24-year-olds, people around my age bracket, will decide to go to a polling station rather than go to the gym or go out for a meal with their friends.
Sorry, I was thinking of the 7-Eleven. I was thinking of going and just getting some chocolate.
It's interesting, and that points up how important our job is here as well, to try and spread the word about how vital these elections are. This is the job that we do. This is the job Devoncast does. It's the job that we do day to day, is cover these things and try and get people out of their seats and get out and vote. You've been listening to Devoncast from Radio X with me, Guy Henderson.
I'm Paul Nero.
And I'm Josh Tate.
We're available on the Radio X website, from your usual podcast provider, and from Devoncast Radio, which you can demand from your smart speaker at any time. Now, the song says God gave rock and roll to you, but if you live in Torbay, Lionel Digby gave it to you. Here's how. Everybody in Torbay knows Lionel Digby. Larger than life, Lionel cuts a distinctive figure. A tall, lean, former soldier, he wears his long grey hair in a ponytail, keeps his white beard tidy, and never goes anywhere without his wide-brimmed hat. There's a pocket watch on a chain in his waistcoat. Lionel, now in his 80s, was in his element the other night when a film about him had its premiere at the Royal Lyceum Theatre in Torquay. Local filmmaker John Tompkins interviewed Lionel about the days when he put on the biggest gigs in the West Country, bringing some of the biggest names in pop and rock music to Torquay Town Hall. He also reassembled some of the South Devon bands who supported the big names. Many of the veteran musicians were there to see themselves on film. Some of them even played during the interval. And there was a surprise bonus when a local musician who started under Lionel's wing and became an international star made a pilgrimage to see his old mentor. Here's John Tompkins.
It's all about legacy and an amazing time for music at the Town Hall from the late 50s, the early 80s, all the legends. But the legend, Lionel Digby, because without him, we wouldn't have all this. He booked the big acts. He started the rock and roll scene in Torbay, but what a legend. It tells a story from the late 50s to the early 80s, all the bands that performed at the Town Hall, the bands that supported the big acts. So you're talking about the Kinks, the Who, Black Sabbath, Fleetwood Mac, David Bowie. There's an amazing story in there. That band went to London from Torbay. David Bowie supported them. What an amazing thing.
Local historian Kevin Dixon was compere for the premiere. A veteran of many Town Hall concerts himself, he explained the importance of the music scene for a town like Torquay.
We're celebrating the legacy of an incredible human being. This is Lionel Digby, and I grew up with him, and every bit of history has got a soundtrack. I've always said that. So, and it's the kind of music that you grew up with between the ages you were like 14 to 23 or something like that. And Lionel provided the soundtrack for nearly everybody in Torbay, everybody in South Devon, and he put on all these remarkable bands that the massive great bands, you know, that you've heard of, the Bowies and the Who and the Rolling Stones, but also he introduced so many of those local bands. And it's the local bands, the guys you'd see in a pub, the guys you'd know, the guys you went to school with, and the next time they're supporting the Who. There will never be another Lionel Digby.
One of the other highlights of the evening was a display of memorabilia, posters and tickets for gigs at the Town Hall, along with some never-before-seen pictures of David Bowie on the stage during his performances there in 1973. Just how much of this stuff has Lionel got?
Keep finding more and more. As I've closed down the warehouse, the costume warehouse, I'm finding boxes of stuff that's been up there for 50 years or more, you know.
And how about running through some of the bands he booked to appear in Torquay?
Will it be easier to give you the names that didn't come?
It probably would.
Well, we got the big names like the Stones, Eric Clapton, the Cream, the Kinks. You've got all the punk, early punk ones.
Guest of honour at the premiere of the film was Martin Turner, a founder member of 70s rock band Wishbone Ash, who played support gigs for the big names at the Town Hall as the Empty Vessels before moving to London and finding fame and fortune. Martin recalled some of Lionel Digby's unconventional marketing methods.
Somebody sent me the poster of tonight with Lionel on it, and there he was in his magnificent glory, the same as I remember him forever, you know, from back in the 60s, you know, when he was riding down the main street on a Saturday afternoon with a Stetson and a six-shooter, sat on top of his shooting break with a sexy girl next to him, telling the whole town that there was a gig tonight at Torquay Town Hall. There was nobody in this town that didn't know about that gig. Lionel made sure that everyone knew.
And there was the time when the beloved and harmless six-shooter Lionel used to brandish around the town got him into hot water with the law. Martin Turner explains, with a little help from the man himself.
I saw him in action one day when we'd all been down in, I think it was the Flamingo Ballroom in Redruth. And we came back that night and everyone was hungry. So we dived into Plymouth Bowling Alley, get a bite to eat. And we ended up surrounded by guys in suits who were like, "We're Plymouth CID, can we see your gun, you know?" And it had a firing pin on it. So they want to see his gun certificate and he didn't have it with him. So he ended up getting taken off to the police station, came back about 3 in the morning, right? We're all sitting in the van and Lionel came back And he gets out of the police car. He brought him back. And he gets out and he's chatting to the cop. He says, right, I'll call you about them gigs, the one on the 28th of August. He booked a couple of bands in for the annual policeman's ball. I'm like, yes, unstoppable.
They said to me, have you got a certificate for this gun? I used to use it on stage, firing it blanks, you know, blanks. And I happened to have it on me when we were in the all-night bowling alley. So they rang up Torquay Police Station. This is when the police station should be open 24 hours a night.
Yeah.
And they said, we've got a Mr. Lionel Digby in here. He says he's got a gun licence. Oh, yeah, we know him. Yes, yes, he's all right. So they let me go.
The empty vessels were just one of the local combos that Lionel helped on their way. And how did they get to be so good and so quick at covering the latest chart hits?
We're doing our apprenticeship, if you like, in the 1960s, playing covers, The Who, all the black soul music that was around, anything and everything. I mean, we used to go up to the music shop in Tor, where we had a friend who was working in the music shop. Dave, give us a copy of the Beatles' new single. He said, well, it's not out till Friday. Dave, give us a copy. You know, this was on Tuesday. It only got released on Friday when everyone just got paid. But we'd get a copy of the Beatles' new single, take it home. We'd do one on the stylus and one on the guitar. We'd have it down in a couple of hours. And the next day, we'd perform it on stage before it was released.
The night of the premiere was a massive success and the Royal Lyceum Theatre was a sellout. They did it again the following night. And that sold out too. It all added up to an emotional occasion for Lionel Digby.
Yeah, rock and roll's with you forever. Rock and roll never dies, you know.
The last word there for the inimitable Lionel Digby. There'll be another showing of that film at Torquay's excellent museum next month. We'll give you a date for that when we have it. And we're coming to the end of Devoncast for this week. Thank you very much for joining me, Josh. Thank you, Paul. You can find Devoncast, as we say, on the Radio X website or wherever you usually find your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you can listen to the next Devoncast the minute it drops. And there's a new way to listen. And seeing we've got you in the studio, Paul, what's Devoncast Radio?
So Devoncast Radio is from Devon's Radio X. It's on DAB digital radio across much of the south of the county in particular. So just over 500,000 adults, children can listen as well, we're not banning you, but in terms of measuring the population, just over 500,000 adults can listen to Devoncast Radio on DAB digital radio in the Torbay, Teignbridge, Exeter, Plymouth, bit of South Ems and South East Cornwall as well. And we've got a range of programmes, so not just this one, but coming up in a moment, there will be another exciting piece of talk radio along the way, which could be Two Locks and a Cox, our Southwest Rugby podcast. It could be the Building Greater Exeter podcast. We've got something from Chiropodist. And if you've got a Devon podcast, either produced in or about Devon, you may be able to get it on Devoncast Radio as well. So you can find the details at devoncastradio.co.uk. And you can always keep up to date with news, travel, information, weather, everything to do with Devon on the Radio X website, radiox.co.uk as well.
And you can contact us by email, news@radiox.co.uk. Thank you for listening. I'm Guy Henderson.
I'm Paul Nero.
And I'm Josh Tate. We'll be back again very soon.
Catch the latest episode of Devoncast every Friday at radiox.co.uk or wherever you get your podcasts.